Enough with the politics, y'all. Can we get back to the economy, please? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, today the 27th of July. Good to have you along, of course. Meetings is where we're at today. That big political thing in Philadelphia, yes. Also, a big economic thing in Washington. The Federal Open Market Committee wrapped up a two-day meeting today. Yeah, you'd forgotten about that one, hadn't you? Yeah, it's all right. Bupkis, as far as changes in interest rates go, even though Dr. Yellen and company did say that the labor market is getting stronger, that household spending is up, and there is continuing, albeit moderate, economic growth. So with all that, what, one might reasonably ask, are they waiting for? Yeah, well, here's the deal. The Fed is increasingly stuck in that rock and a hard place between an economy that's doing one thing and a body politic that is doing an entirely different thing. From our desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman gets us going.
Janet Yellen thinks a lot about economic data, which are getting stronger. But that's not all she has to deal with. There's the political calendar, too, says Steve Murphy at Capital Economics.
The Fed historically has swayed from doing anything that's deemed to be in response to what's going on politically, especially in an election year.
And what a volatile, unpredictable election year. If you're the Fed trying to figure out what businesses will do, Bernie Baumol at the Economic Outlook Group says,
you want to make sure that you have some appreciation of what the economic climate will be.
And from his perspective, that economic climate is clouded by highly unorthodox economic proposals from Republican Donald Trump.
You've got a candidate that actually says they will be able to renegotiate the payment terms on the U.S. national debt, so that foreign and U.S. investors may end up getting less than 100 cents on the dollar.
Economist Douglas Holtz-Eakin, who chaired President George H.W. Bush's Council of Economic Advisers, isn't so alarmed.
Any notion that somehow the U.S. would not pay in full and in a timely fashion on U.S. treasuries is simply abhorrent. Shouldn't contemplate that. Interestingly enough, when he said those things, markets didn't react at all. So they either don't think he'll be elected or don't think anyone will really do that.
Holtz-Eakin thinks the real uncertainty that markets and the Fed face right now is simply not knowing which party and economic ideology will be ascendant come November. And that, he says, is the same in any election year. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
TWTR was the saddest ticker symbol you'd ever want to see on Wall Street today. Shares down 14% plus after what can only be called an abysmal earnings report after the close yesterday for Twitter. Slow revenue growth, lousy predictions for future revenue growth, basically flat user numbers. All of that would seem to bode ill, especially as Facebook reported a boatload of fresh revenue in its earnings today. As we do when the tech news demands, we've called our senior tech correspondent Molly Wood to make me smart. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
So we had a conversation the other day, you and I, offline, about Twitter's future, really, and how conceivably they could be the next Yahoo. Discuss, would you, in light of these earnings numbers?
Yeah, you know, there's some important ways in which Twitter is obviously not the same as Yahoo, but the ways in which it could be the same are that Twitter will probably find itself in the same long, slow decline as it struggles to define itself. That's kind of the most obvious parallel. We have been asking the question for years, what is Twitter? Mm-hmm. And Twitter's been unable to answer it. That's a question that plagued Yahoo. What are we and what do we want to be and what is our core product and how will we make money on that product? Yahoo actually made a lot of money on its product, but it's that explaining the core product to future users that both of them mm-hmm. kind of are failing at.
Okay, so I'm on board with that, and I get it. The question, though, that comes out of that, and especially in light of Facebook's earnings report today, in which they made boatloads of money, is this. You remember 3-4 years ago, maybe five now, I guess, in which we were all, not we all, but people were saying, look, Facebook is doomed because it hasn't figured out the mobile thing. They're just getting, what the heck, they're going to go away. And here they are now running the world.
To be fair, that was also a little bit of an IPO filing trap. Facebook said, in its IPO filing, if we can't figure out mobile, we will have a problem.
Yeah.
And it was a technology problem to solve. Like, let's remember going in that Facebook never had a problem getting users, engaging mm-hmm. them, keeping them interested in the platform, and more importantly, explaining its mission. They've got a one simple sentence, connect people. Neither Twitter nor Yahoo could do that. And so if your core problem is technology, that's no problem. We're lousy with engineers. It's mission that is the problem.
Molly Wood is our senior tech correspondent, and that, ladies and gentlemen, is why we call her up. Molly, thanks.
My pleasure, Kai.
Elsewhere on Wall Street, better than Twitter, let's just say that. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. On this day after Hillary Clinton became the first woman to be nominated at the top of a major party ticket, a quick call back to the first time she ran and a book about that 2008 election called Big Girls Don't Cry. Rebecca Traister wrote it. She writes about the Clinton campaign now for New York Magazine. Her most recent book about how unmarried women are shaping this country's political and economic future is called All the Single Ladies. Rebecca, welcome to the program.
It's good to be here.
Single women in this country today, you write, are living their lives, and this is a quote, outside the institutions around which tax, housing, and social policies were designed. That is kind of amazing, really.
It is very amazing. It's a rethinking of how, not only how families work and how they're defined, but how our civic and social and economic policies need to be redefined to accommodate new marriage patterns and the ways in which adult women and men are living today, as opposed to how they lived even just 40 or 50 years ago.
And yet this isn't really yet reshaping the economic landscape, right? We've still got the wage and income gap. We've still got all the rest of that stuff that goes along with it.
Well, it's certainly reshaping how we're talking about economic and social policy on the left. I was stunned during the 2016 primary between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders that so many of the arguments revolved around, their shared support for so many policies that just a few years ago would have been considered really third rail. And that includes mandated paid family leave, the raising of the minimum wage. And I think that shows certainly the influence of a left candidate like Bernie Sanders, but also the way that the party has moved and that our ideas about what makes sense in terms of our economic and social policies has shifted as we have begun to live differently as a nation.
So spitball it for me a little bit and carry that thought from the primaries into now the general election, bearing in mind, as you say, that we have never seen Hillary Clinton in a general election campaign.
We have never seen Hillary Clinton in a general election campaign. We've only seen her in the case of 2008 with Barack Obama and in 2016 against Bernie Sanders, men who have good politics and who she can't really hit too hard. As a general election candidate, we are seeing her being able to fight a kind of right-wing aggressor in the form of Donald Trump. It's interesting that she, who has often historically been considered the centrist compromise candidate, she's going to be in the position of fighting what is interestingly a pretty left-wing fight.
Does she recognize, though, how her female constituency has changed, do you think?
I think she does understand how people's lives have changed. She's talking more about unmarried women, breadwinners within families. We forget often that she was branded at the beginning of her career as an advocate, as a lawyer, and then certainly even when she became First Lady, as a real radical leftist. Now, I don't think she was a radical leftist, whether you think she's just a natural shapeshifter or whether you think that, in fact, she got the message that that was too much too soon and retracted some of that. She's now returning to ground that is very familiar to her.
You wrote a great piece in New York Magazine about Hillary Clinton on the campaign trail. You went out and you spent some time with her when she was out on the stump. And one of the things you talk about is the charisma factor and how she admits she's not a great campaigner and she's not a great public speaker. But maybe it's time for us to revisit how we consider that thing that a lot of male politicians, as Secretary Clinton says, her husband, Barack Obama, have, which is this perception among the American public of great charisma.
Yeah, we have models of leadership, and they often involve great men who have historically been our presidents giving great speeches. Women historically have been the ones who have done what is often viewed as the drudge work of making these things happen, organizing rallies and speeches. They haven't been the ones giving the speeches. There's also the thing about intimacy and charisma, the other metric we so often use and that we often deride, the do you want to have a beer with them factor.
Right.
one of the challenges that they have in front of them is to not present themselves as too intimate, being too personal, weak, feminine. And so they've had to assert themselves with credentials and experience and prove that they can do the job better. But that does not lend itself to you want to have a beer with them. That does not lend itself to the relaxed approach to power that more men are permitted to take because we assume from the outset that they're capable.
Rebecca Traister is a writer at New York Magazine. Her most recent book is called All the Single Ladies. It's a good one. You should read it. Rebecca, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Coming up.
Owen actually has so many scenes in his head, but he uses them for key moments to identify emotions and to really express himself.
Disney movies and a life animated. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off about a point and a half. Today we'll call that flat, 18,472. The NASDAQ up 29 points, a half percent, 51.39. The S&P 500 went the other way, down 2 points, a tenth percent, 21.66. Bank stocks were mostly up after the Fed's announcement. Bank of America up 0.6%. Citigroup and JPMorgan Chase each climbed 0.3% today. Apple up 6.5%. And Garmin shares soared after the navigation company raised its full-year profit forecast, citing its move into wearable technology. Garmin rose 11.6% today. Coca-Cola said revenue declined more than expected in the latest quarter, blamed weak sales overseas. Coke shares fizzled, fell 3.3%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell a full half of 1%. Listen to this, from 1.56 to 1.50%. That's a lot, actually. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today, from our desk of what could possibly go wrong, mortgages with super quick approvals and no cash down. Yep. Except then, I guess this is the saving grace that this time it's not necessarily unqualified buyers that lenders are catering to. It's the hopefully rich one day tech workers in Silicon Valley. Marketplace's Sally Herships has that one.
First of all, yep.
Well, there's no doubt about it. These are risky loans.
Susan Wachter teaches real estate and finance at Wharton. She says often Silicon Valley workers' money is tied up in stock, which may or may not turn out to be worth anything.
You're cash poor, you're illiquid, but you want a home now. You may be in an age where you have children.
And want a house. But Wachter says as long as lenders diversify, they should be okay. Besides, she says, loans like these are about way more than one mortgage. They're about a relationship.
And this is where you're going to get your second loan for your second home. This is where you're going to perhaps borrow for your children's.
Which may be why First Republic Bank has offices at Twitter and Facebook. It wants to meet young programmers. But it's not just tech workers who qualify for deals.
No, yeah, they've been doing doctor and attorney loans.
Rocky Andrews is president of the National Association of Mortgage Brokers. He says many banks are now offering deals to who they consider to be the cream of the professional crop.
Not necessarily zero down, but like 3% down or, you know, or very minimal amount down.
And if I were a banker, that's probably a better bet than offering them to line workers at an automobile assembly plant across the bay in Fremont.
Richard Parker is with Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He says there's another problem with these mortgages besides risk.
So that things that are available to the 1% or the 5% are not available to the 99 or the 95.
Way different than before 2008. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Some students from Yale University are setting up Connecticut's first bail fund. They're going to pay bail for low-income offenders who'd otherwise be stuck in jail on minor charges. New York City has at least two bail funds in the Bronx and Brooklyn. It's considering doing something citywide. Chicago and Massachusetts have charitable bail funds going as well. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour has that story.
For a lot of people accused of a crime, bail is their way out of jail. For others, it's the lock on the door keeping them in.
There's people sitting in jail right now because they cannot afford low bond.
Simone Seaver is a co-director of the Connecticut Bail Fund. Bonds of even a few hundred dollars can trap a low-income person in jail. Advocates say the problem extends far beyond Connecticut. Joshua Norkin is with the Legal Aid Society of New York.
You can walk into any single courtroom in any of the five boroughs, and anyone can see it.
He says people who can't afford bail suffer serious consequences without ever being convicted of anything.
You could lose your job. It could damage a relationship that you're in. It could have an impact on your housing situation.
It's essentially the criminalization of poverty.
Brett Davidson is another co-founder of the Connecticut Bail Fund.
People end up incarcerated because they can't afford bail, and that incentivizes people to take guilty plea bargains just to get out of pretrial detention, which essentially erases the presumption of innocence.
So the Connecticut Bail Fund will pay off small bonds, likely anything less than $3,000, for indigent people. Doing so doesn't appear to remove an incentive to show up to court. 96% of people helped by similar funds in the Bronx and Brooklyn make their court dates. Jeff Clayton is with the American Bail Coalition, an industry group for commercial bail providers.
I haven't seen it materialize into a threat to the existing bail industry. I mean, it seems to me that they are trying to serve a population that we either can't serve or won't serve.
The Connecticut Bail Fund's expected to start operating in September. In New York, I'm Sabri Benashour for Marketplace.
There's a documentary film that's open nationwide this week. It's called Life Animated, about a 23-year-old guy with autism named Owen Susskind and what his life is like as he grows up and he moves out on his own. The film is based on a book of the same title by Owen's dad, Ron Susskind, a reporter at the Wall Street Journal for many years, also an author, obviously. The animated in the title, you should know, is Disney. Disney Movies, to be specific. Owen and Ron Susskind, welcome both of you to the program.
Thank you.
Nice to be here.
Nice to be here.
Ron, I want to start with you. And one of many clips in this film from home videos early on when Owen was a baby that make you just sit back and go, whoa. There is one where you're out in the yard and you're sword fighting and he's pretend sword fighting, I should say.
Owen, who are you?
I'm Peter Pan. And you?
Oh, I'm Captain Hook. You're Peter Pan. Okay, come on, man.
And he's just a little kid running around the yard playing with his dad. And then something starts to happen. Tell me what that was.
Well, that's a last few days in which we say we lived on the planet normal. Cornelia and I, my wife, we had two boys, Owen and Walter. Walt was five. Owen was about 2.5. And we were just living the traditional life, the life in a way that felt pretty ideal to us. Then Owen and I are just doing what any dad and a little 2.5-year-old would do. We're doing the Peter Pan sword fight.
Peter Pan, Captain of Sword Fight.
That's right.
I guess I was saying, he's not a boy. He's
a flying devil.
And that was just a month before Owen starts to go down a path. He loses speech. He loses motor function. He can't meet your gaze. He just kind of vanished. Cornelia and I just said, what could this be? It was like we were looking for clues to a kidnapping. And a few months later, he's diagnosed as autistic, regressive autism.
There is then a scene in which you have had some inkling that he's kind of paying attention to Disney movies, right? And you go up to his room and you see this puppet of Iago, right? It's the what kind of bird is it, Owen?
It is... from Disney's Aladdin, remember Iago, the evil, wacky, hilarious parrot?
Now, look, I knew that Owen loved this movie. Owen was about almost 7 years old at this point. He's up to about a three-word sentence after we basically spent all of our money on therapies, like a lot of parents do with kids in the spectrum. And we realized that he was living inside of these Disney movies. He loved the movies. He watched them incessantly. And so I grabbed the puppet. I pull it up to my elbow. It's one of the big ones.
Yeah.
And I crawl to the edge of the bed. I push the puppet up.
Yeah.
And I talk to Owen in Gilbert Gottfried's voice.
Oh, Owen, how does it feel to be you?
And I say, not good, because I don't have any friends.
And oh my gosh.
And this is our first conversation, I mean, since he's 2 years old.
Owen, do you remember this day?
Yes, I do.
Owen has an amazing memory. It's part of what I call his compensatory gifts. And so Owen's like a walking IMDb right now.
I sure am.
And also, this is a little bit sideways, Owen, but did you teach yourself to read reading the credits in Disney movies?
Uh-huh.
Wow.
You know, it's really tapping Owen's intrinsic motivation, the neuroscientists call it. It's passion. It's what he loved, and he wanted to know who was behind the screen of light where he'd spent so much time.
What was it, Owen, though, about Disney in particular, right? Because there's no shortage of movies out there for kids to watch.
They're fun, magical, colorful, and entertaining to little kids. And all guys and girls of all ages. And they're emotional.
Oh, Owen actually has so many scenes in his head.
Got all of them, right?
Every scene, hundreds of hours. Yeah. But he uses them for key moments to identify emotions and to really express himself.
Do you have a favorite, by the way, Owen?
I love them all, but my number one favorite is Aladdin.
How come?
Because it's magical, fun-loving, playful, wacky, hilarious, and entertaining. And it shows you to accept who you really are inside.
Right.
Yeah, do Kai a little. Do a little Yagi for Kai.
Give me a little.
Wait a minute, Jafar! What if you were the chump husband? Okay. You married the princess, all right? Then you become the sultan!
I'm going to watch Disney movies with a whole new light from now on. Owen also tells his own tale, sort of. I mean, at one point you talk about him going down into the basement and drawing and drawing and drawing, and you discover, and Owen, I know you remember this because you talk about it in the movie, he's drawn a really good cartoons of all the sidekicks in the Disney movies, right? No heroes in this book that Owen wrote. It's just the sidekicks.
Well, it was after a tough time in Owen's life, and he, he started to develop a kind of response, a kind of philosophy, actually.
I felt sort of like a sidekick and not a hero.
And you started to draw the sidekicks with enormous intensity.
I sure did.
There are hundreds of them in Disney.
Of course there are.
Who are some of your favorites?
Jiminy Cricket, Phil, and Lucky Jack, and Mushu, and others, Sebastian.
Is that the lobster in Little Mermaid, right?
It's the crab, Sebastian, and the Little Mermaid. Yeah.
You know, we live in a time when so many people feel like sidekicks and not heroes in this country. And Owen's idea is, the sidekick is the key character, the key actor in the drama.
Right.
A sidekick helps the hero fulfill his destiny. And we're all really sidekicks searching for our inner hero.
Speaking of what movies are about, Ron, you say at some point in this movie, what you want for Owen. And what you hope his life is. And you basically talk about this bigger question of who gets to decide what a meaningful life is, right? Explain that a little bit.
Well, it's something that Cornelia and I started to say to each other about 20 years ago. After Owen was diagnosed, he forced us to ask ourselves a deeper set of questions. In some ways, he pushed us into an investigation of what it means to be human. You know, we could see the way people looked at Owen, often long enough to look away or stared at him. And you could see how they viewed him as less and that his life was not a life of meaning. And it deeply upset us. And we said, who makes that decision, what the meaningful life is? Recently, the folks at the Disney animation studios saw the movie for the first time. The actual animators say, Owen sees more in our characters than we did, and we made them. And what's interesting is that at one point during the screening, one of the animators brought up just the question, that line that you mentioned, Kai, who decides what the meaningful life is? And Owen said,
I do.
And the place rose in cheers.
It's a film called Life Animated. Owen Susskind and his dad, Ron. Thank you both very much for coming in. I do appreciate it.
Hey, thanks, Kai.
Thanks.
This final note on the way out today, I'm just going to revisit those Facebook earnings numbers real quick that Molly and I touched on because they are honestly kind of amazing. The company now has 1.71 billion monthly average users. That is plus or minus a quarter of the people on the entire planet. Second quarter revenue, that is the quarter they announced today, $6.4 billion. Also, on a daily basis, by the way, 92% of its users
are on mobile. So, yeah, I think they got that thing figured out, huh? All right, we got to go. The Dow flat today, down about a point and a half. The NASDAQ up 29 points. That's a half percent, 5139. The S&P 500 off about 2.5 points, 10%, closed at 2166. Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lynch, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Troughton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.